Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 833, titled Shooting Ourselves in the Foot in Ukraine, subtitled Habsburg Redux. This is being recorded on January 30th of the year 2015. First, before we get into the program, every For the Record broadcast is turned into a long article-length description featuring all of the material that is included in the program and often material that is not in the original broadcast itself due to the limitations of time. Also, be aware that you can subscribe to the comments that are made on the various posts on SpitfireList.com where the descriptions for each program are posted, and in particular, some of the expert contributions from Terra Fractal, an associate editor, constitute a very important ongoing flow of critical news and information in and of themselves. At the top of the description for the Record 833 is a link to which you can go in order to subscribe to the comments that are posted. Now, this program is yet another broadcast in our series about Ukraine and will serve to underscore some of the reasons that I have been focusing on this so much, some of the concerns. Not only have we been witnessing a fundamental perversion of historical and political reality with documented historical fact about the OUNB, Nazi collaborating fascists of World War II's political heirs being installed in Ukraine, and that has happened. We are seeing a series of maneuvers that could result in any one of a number of a number of very distasteful developments, ranging from a global financial crisis, and we're going to begin talking about that, conceivably if the strategy of regime change in Russia, which certainly appears to be the focal point of Western policy, and more about that later, if that were to take place, we might see an ascension to power in Russia of real Russian fascists, because they are present and they are gaining military experience in Ukraine. More about that. Or perhaps the greatest of the possible negative outcomes of this concerns nuclear war. And we're going to hear some ruminations by former Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev, who helped to end the Cold War, about the possibility of nuclear war in Ukraine, in nuclear war over the crisis in Ukraine. In For the Record Program 824, we took a look at some of the historical roots of the Ukraine crisis and the OUNB diaspora, and took a look at the analysis presented by George Eliasson, E-L-I-A-S-O-N, and who documented the chain of events now unfolding in Ukraine, going back to the mid-19th century, where the Habsburg Empire initiated its Spring of Nations concept, in which the various nations or nationalities under its control were basically encouraged to have at one level a virulent and violent nationalism, but that fit within the larger mosaic of enthusiastic participation in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And we're going to be taking a look at Habsburg Redux, so to speak. We're going to be taking a look at the activism of some of the heirs to the House of Habsburg, their ascension to political limelight in various countries, including Georgia and Hungary and Austria, as well as Ukraine. And we're going to be taking a look in particular at their activities with regard to Ukraine. More about that, however, in a little bit. And we will, time permitting, reflect a little bit on the participation of some members of the ruling houses of Europe, the various monarchies that governed Europe for the longest period of time, and not only their reascension to a certain extent on the national, on the international stage, but also the fact that they were openly and combatively supportive of fascism in World War II. We're going to begin our program with a long article that was penned by Jonathan Marshall, last name M-A-R-S-H-A-L-L, a name familiar to longtime listeners and one well represented in our archives. Jonathan Marshall has been doing political work for a long time, is actually the son of Peter Dale Scott. And we're going to begin with an article by Jonathan Marshall on the Consortium News website. The article was posted on January 19th of the year 2015. The article is titled, Risky Blowback from Russian Sanctions. And in this, Jonathan Marshall warns about the possibility of a global financial contagion spreading from a possible Russian credit default, and also discusses the effects of the sanctions on Europe proper. Marshall also talks about the possible implications of regime change in Russia, if in fact that were to be brought about, and many in Russia suspect that is the goal of Western activity. I believe that they are in, probably absolutely correct. Beyond that, I think that the real goal is ultimately the breakup of Russia into a number of smaller countries, which would be relatively powerless before Western power, and in particular, relatively powerless to discipline some of the transnational corporations that would love to get their hands on the abundant natural resources of Russia. I think China faces a similar fate, and one of the ironies of the U.S. backing the Spring of Nations ultra-nationalist and exceptionalist policy formed by the Habsburgs and perpetuated by the Third Reich in both its World War II above-ground manifestation and its post-war underground manifestation as well, is that ultimately, in my opinion, as we have looked at in some of our Going Native series, such as For the Record 550, and numbers 615 and 616, I think that ultimately the U.S. will be partitioned by that very same Spring of Nations, so to speak, sword. In any event, the first article by Jonathan Marshall, Consortium News, January 19th, 2015, Risky Blowback from Russian Sanctions. And Jonathan Marshall begins his analysis with this introduction. Today's American foreign policy, quote, elite, unquote, rarely thinks through the dangerous consequences of its tough guy actions, including its new plan to provoke economic and political chaos in nuclear-armed Russia, a strategy, unquote, that is also spreading pain and disorder to Europe, as Jonathan Marshall explains. And the article itself reads, last month, as President Barack Obama prepared to sign tougher sanctions legislation aimed at Russia, the top White House economist Jason Furman, F-U-R-M-A-N, boasted that the West's economic warfare was already bringing Russia to its knees. If I was chairman, should have been if I were chairman, bad English, Mr. Furman, if I were chairman of President Vladimir Putin's Council of Economic Advisers, I would be extremely concerned, Furman said, declaring that Putin and his circle were, quote, between a rock and a hard place in economic policy, unquote. Furman crowed that, quote, the combination of our sanctions, the uncertainty they've created for themselves with their international actions, and the falling price of oil has put their economy on the brink of crisis, unquote. There is no denying the perilous state of Russia's economy. 1 month earlier, Russia's finance minister, Anton Siluanov, S-I-L-U-A-N-O-V, had predicted that sanctions and lower oil prices would cost the Russian economy as much as $140 billion, equal to about 7% of GDP. Over the course of 2014, the ruble lost 46% of its value, only to drop another 7% on the first day of trading in 2015. Russia's central bank estimates that the country suffered net capital outflows of $134 billion last year, setting the stage for a painful depression. Quote, "We are going through a trying period, difficult times at the moment," unquote, Putin conceded to a large group of international reporters only days after Furman's comments. But as scholars and pundits have been telling us for years, in today's globalized world, no major problem, economic, political, or military, stays local for long. Punishing Russia for its annexation of Crimea and its continuing support for Ukrainian rebels is likely to create a host of unintended and costly repercussions for both the U.S. and Europe. Unlike some targets of U.S. sanctions like Cuba or North Korea, Russia's economy is big enough to matter. Its freefall may well drag the precarious EU economies partway down with it. Asked by Bloomberg News whether the world could see a financial contagion resulting from Russia's economic plight, West Shore Fund's global strategist James Rickards, R-I-C-K-A-R-D-S, said, quote, "I think we will. This resembles 1997-98 more than it resembles the 2007-2008 panic. Remember, that started in Thailand in June of 1997. Then it spread to Indonesia, then to South Korea, with blood on the streets in both places. People were killed in riots. Then it spread to Russia itself. It was the classic example of contagion," unquote. Rickards added, quote, "There's a lot of dollar-denominated corporate debt in Russia that they may not be able to pay. If that stuff starts to default, who owns it? Well, it's owned by U.S. mutual fund investors. It's in 401ks. Some of it is in European banks. If you own Banco Santander," S-A-N-T-A-N-D-E-R, "and Banco Santander has a big slug of Russian corporate debt, how does it go down? They can point a finger at the Russians, but when that debt goes down, it's going to come back to haunt us," unquote. That is hardly a fringe concern. Thomas Friedman has also sounded the alarm. Quote, "Russia's decline is bad for Russians, but that doesn't mean it is good for us. When the world gets this interconnected and interdependent, you get a strategic reverse. Your friends, through economic mismanagement, see Greece, can harm you faster than your enemies. And your rivals, falling, see Russia and China, can be more dangerous than your rivals rising. If Russia, an economy spanning 9 time zones, goes into recession and cannot pay foreign lenders with its lower oil revenues, and all this leads to political turmoil and defaults to Western banks, that crash would be felt globally," unquote. European leaders appear to be having second thoughts about the wisdom of playing a game of economic chicken when their own national economies are so very weak. Austrian, French, German, and Italian leaders meeting at the Brussels summit in December all warned that Russia's financial crisis could blow back against their own economies. The goal was never to push Russia politically and economically into chaos, unquote, said Germany's Vice Chancellor, Sigmar, S-I-G-M-A-R, Gabriel, G-A-B-R-I-E-L. In a similar spirit, French President François Hollande told a radio interviewer that sanctions, which included the cancellation of the delivery of 2 Mistral helicopter carriers to Russia, were both unnecessary and counterproductive. Quote, Mr. Putin does not want to annex eastern Ukraine, unquote, Vagon said. What he wants is to remain influential. What Mr. Putin wants is that Ukraine not become a member of NATO, unquote. As for sanctions, Alon said, I'm not for the policy of attaining goals by making things worse. I think that sanctions must stop now. Such concerns did not dissuade Congress last month from unanimously paying Such concerns did not dissuade Congress last month from unanimously passing tough new bans on financing and technology transfers, along with $350 million in arms and military equipment to Ukraine and $90 million for anti-Putin propaganda and political operations in Russia itself. Former Representative Dennis Kucinich noted that this momentous legislation passed the House of Representatives late at night, with only three members of the House of Representatives present. Again, these last couple of sentences, because they are doozies. Such concerns and did not dissuade Congress last month from unanimously passing two new bans on financing and technology transfers, along with $350 million in arms and military equipment to Ukraine and $90 million for anti-Putin propaganda and political operations in Russia. Former Representative Dennis Kucinich noted that this momentous legislation passed the House of Representatives late at night with only three members of the House of Representatives present. That is really stunning, and we'll come back to this more later, aside from the fact that we are literally providing weapons to the unrepentant, in fact, celebratory heirs to the OUNB World War II Nazi butchers, collaborating butchers of Stefan Bandera et al. Just imagine, and we'll come back to this, just imagine if the Duma, that's the Russian parliament, passed a bill which was then signed by President Putin to allocate $90 million for anti-Obama propaganda and political operations inside of the United States proper. How do you think that people in this country would react? Can you imagine what we would be hearing on our media? And if this, in turn, had passed with exactly three members of the House of Representatives present, that is a momentous thing to do and a very arrogant thing to do. And with just three members of the House of Representatives present, and we are not hearing about this. We will come back to this later. More from Jonathan Marshall from Consortium News of January 19th of 2015. A section called Careful What You Wish For. Promiscuous use of sanctions against Russia and a host of other international targets ironically could come back to haunt the U.S. by undermining the very neoliberal principles it has championed for decades to undergird U.S. economic expansion. President Putin sounded more like a leader of the Trilateral Commission than an ex-KGB officer when he warned last fall, quote, sanctions are already undermining the foundations of world trade, the WTO rules, and the principle of inviolability of private property. And continuing. They, meaning the West, are dealing a blow to the liberal model of globalization based on markets, freedom, and competition, which, let me note, is a model that has primarily benefited precisely those Western countries. And now they risk losing trust as the leaders of globalization. We have to ask ourselves, why was this necessary? After all, the United States' prosperity rests in large part on the trust of investors and foreign holders of dollars and U.S. securities. This trust is clearly being undermined, and signs of disappointment in the fruits of globalization are visible now in many countries, unquote. Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group and foreign affairs columnist for Time magazine, echoed President Putin's comments in his recent global survey, Top Risks of 2015, which warned that, quote, American unilateralism is stoking dangerous trends, unquote, around the world. Again, quoting, I'm very far from a pessimist, but for the first time since starting the firm in 1998, I'm starting to feel a serious undercurrent of geopolitical foreboding, unquote. With regard to economic sanctions, Bremer observed, the most important near-term challenge is the damage inflicted on transatlantic relations. Europe will become more frustrated with an American unilateralism that Europe and European banks must pay for. Also, the U.S. could well slap new sanctions on Russia and or Iran, eliciting a backlash in 2015. On the longer term, though, others will diversify away from reliance on the dollar and U.S.-dominated institutions, particularly in East Asia, where China has the muscle and the motive to create its own institutions, and where there is less dollar-denominated debt to complicate the process. And a fat-tail concern for 2015 also related to the rise of strategic sectors. Governments targeted by sanctions will increasingly treat companies that imply with them as instruments of American power, from regulatory harassment to contract discrimination to cyber attacks. The U.S. financial sector is particularly vulnerable on this count, unquote. The long-term consequences of such sanctions could extend far beyond the cost to our own and other Western economies. Already, U.S.-Russian cooperation on arms control has been imperiled. Pushed to the wall, Russia may decline to continue its essential cooperation with regard to resupply corridors into Afghanistan, the Iran nuclear negotiations, and a political settlement in Syria, all of which rank far higher in any rational list of priorities than the fate of the eastern Ukraine. As Bremer warned, quote, a Kremlin that feels antagonized and isolated but not substantially constrained is a dangerous prospect. An aggressively revisionist yet increasingly weak Russia will be a volatile actor on the global stage in 2015, posing a top risk to Western governments and businesses throughout the year, unquote. He predicted the possibility of more stealth cyber attacks, confrontation with NATO, and tighter bonding between Russia and China at the expense of the West. If, as many Russians believe, the real aim of sanctions is regime change, just as President Nixon promoted a military coup against Chile's Salvador Allende by ordering policies to, quote, make the economy scream, unquote, most observers agree the West could end up with a far more antagonistic regime post-Putin. In the short run, of course, sanctions simply inflame Russian nationalism and bolster Putin's popularity. But in the longer run, observed Russia expert Angus Roxburgh, R-O-X-B-U-R-G-H, in The Guardian, quote, pouring fuel on Kremlin clan wars that we barely understand would be the height of folly. We have no idea what the outcome might be, and it could be much worse than what we have at present, unquote. The longer the Ukraine conflict simmers, the more extremists on both sides gain leverage. Writing last September in the Moscow Times, Natalia Yudina, Y-U-D-I-N-A, noted that, quote, a significant number of right-wing Russian radicals are now actively fighting in Ukraine. Whereas they previously took part in social networks, historic war battle reenactment groups, and all sorts of quasi-military training camps, they are now gaining real-world combat experience. Following the conclusion of the conflict, most will inevitably return to Russia, where their long-standing dreams of staging a Russian revolt, unquote, or white revolution, unquote, will no longer seem so difficult an accomplishment. And that means that one more consequence of this war will be a sharp escalation of activity by right-wing radicals, only this time in Russia itself, unquote. Without a crystal ball, we have no way of knowing whether the new Cold War with Russia will thaw or go into a deeper freeze. But it seems abundantly clear that economic sanctions and political confrontation over the fate of the eastern Ukraine magnify the risks to global order far out of proportion to any real U.S. and Western interests. It's worth remembering, with the centenary of World War I just passed, that economic collapse and social disruption are more likely to sow the seeds of extremism and conflict than to make the world safe for democracy. If policymakers look to history for policy guidance, they would be well advised to study the lessons of their side rather than staying fixated on those of Munich. And again, I think that all needs to be evaluated against the very obvious fact that there was a coup in Ukraine that was the direct outgrowth of covert operation by Western intelligence and allied NGOs. And at the core of that covert operation was the reinstallation of the OUNB Nazis from World War II, who have maintained basically a very effective institutional fascism over the decades, and those elements have been installed in power in Ukraine. We wound up the program last week with an article from the Financial Times about how NATO has put together what really is sort of a ministry of truth in the Orwellian sense to combat, quote, Russian or Kremlin propaganda, unquote. One of the many things I find grotesquely alarming about what is taking place is the complete Orwellian reversal of fact, where documented historical and political fact about the OUNB, outright fascist, outright collaborators of the Nazis, very lavish, enthusiastic participants in the activities of the SS and the Einsatzgruppen, are back in power in Ukraine, and yet we are being told that this is just Russian propaganda. Again, it is tantamount to President Putin saying 2 + 2 = 4, and we're being told that the Kremlin is disseminating mathematical propaganda with a repeated claim that 2 + 2 = 4. NATO has put together a body of experts who are going to use the media to counteract this propaganda and to make it clear to the public that 2 + 2 really = 7. I mean, it is that bleeping bad, and that is very bad indeed. Note in that article that not only were $350 million appropriated for arming the fascists now in Ukraine, there was also $90 million that was allocated for political operations and anti-Putin propaganda in Russia itself. Can you imagine, again, the uproar in the U.S. if there really is no basis for comparison between Russia and the U.S. But suppose, for the sake of argument, the U.S. had been invaded in World War II, and if 27 million Americans had been killed in that invasion, that's the number of Russians and Soviet citizens who died, and if everything from Chicago eastward had been destroyed, and that is the equivalent damage that was done to Russia, and then if the military forces and political forces behind that invasion had been resuscitated by Russian intelligence and gradually installed as part of an anti-American Russian-based military alliance, and were gradually installed in places in Latin America, walking up through Central America right to the U.S. border. And then if in Mexico, combatants aligned with the political heirs of that began a war and began conducting raids into the U.S. And killing American citizens who were in Mexico, How do you think the U.S. would respond to that if Russian warships and airplanes were basically inhabiting the waters and airspace just off the U.S. in combination with that? How do you think that we would feel? Plus, again, suppose Russia laid out $90 million for political warfare in the U.S. How do you think that would go over? I would also note that as we took stock of In For The Record 784, the darling of Western political activists is in Russia, is a guy named Alexei Navalny, who is something of a new order or new wave fascist and is actively networking with the most reactionary and overtly Nazi elements inside of Russia. By the way, I would note that WikiLeaks is heavily networked with Russian and Belarusian fascist elements, as we have looked at in For the Record 745, among others. And again, we are arming the fascists in Ukraine, and American advisors have begun the process of doing that. This was promised some time ago. I would note that these American advisors are helping to arm and train the Ukrainian National Guard that was just formed. That National Guard incorporates the volunteer battalions, the Nazi units that are basically the equivalent of the Einsatzgruppen in World War II. They are openly Nazi and celebratory of the SS legacy. And also, U.S. advisors and equipment are going to bolster the Ukrainian police forces as well. The chief of police in the city of Kiev is the former deputy commander of the openly Nazi Azov battalion. An article from Defense News of January 22nd of 2015 by Paul McCleary, capital M-C, capital L-E-A-R-Y, U.S. trainers deploy to Ukraine. It reads in part, American soldiers were deployed to Ukraine this spring to begin training four companies of the Ukrainian National Guard. The head of the U.S. Army in Europe, Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, said during his first visit to Kiev on Wednesday. The number of troops heading to the Yavoriv training area near the city of Lvov, which is about 40 miles from the Polish border, is still being determined, however. The American training effort comes as part of a U.S. State Department initiative, quote, to assist Ukraine in strengthening its law enforcement capabilities, conduct internal defense, and maintain rule of law, unquote, Pentagon spokeswoman Lieutenant Colonel Vanessa Hillman told Defense News. The training was requested by the Ukrainian government, quote, as they work to reform their police forces and establish their newly formed National Guard, unquote, Hillman said. That includes the Azov Battalion and the other Nazi and fascist volunteer battalions, skipping down. We're very open to the idea that this becomes a first step in further training for the Ukrainian military, unquote, Derek Chollet, or Cholet, C-H-O-L-L-E-T, former Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, told Defense News just before he left the Pentagon on January 17th. Skipping down. One of the biggest challenges for U.S. policymakers is trying to discern, quote, where this could lead and how does this make us think anew about European security issues and force posture issues or defense spending issues, unquote, he said. In addition to U.S. trainers, Washington is beginning to provide heavier military equipment to the government in Kiev. On Monday, the U.S. delivered the first prototype of an armored Kozak, K-O-Z-A-K, vehicle for use with the Ukrainian border guard, according to the U.S. embassy there. Yeah, indeed, although I don't think this is the sense that Derek Chollet, or Cholet, I don't know how that's pronounced again, C-H-O-L-L-E-T, we better start thinking very carefully about where this could lead. And aside from the political and economic fallout of various kinds, set forth, I think, very clearly by Jonathan Marshall in the article with which we began our program. There is another possibility as well. From the Reuters.com website of January 9th of 2015, an article by Eric Kirschbaum, K-I-R-S-C-H-B-A-U-M, Gorbachev warns of major war in Europe. Former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev warned that tensions between Russia and European powers over the Ukraine crisis could result in a major conflict or even nuclear war in an interview to appear in a German news magazine on Saturday. A war of this kind would unavoidably lead to a nuclear war, unquote, the 1990 Nobel Peace Prize winner told Der Spiegel news magazine, according to excerpts released on Friday. Quote, "We won't survive the coming years if someone loses their nerve in this overheated situation," added Gorbachev, 83. "This is not something I'm saying thoughtlessly. I am extremely concerned," unquote. Skipping down. "The new Germany wants to intervene everywhere," he said in the interview. Again, quoting, "In Germany, evidently, there are a lot of people who want to help create a new division in Europe." Well, he's quite right. I would add that those same elements are very much present in the U.S., grouped around the very important Ukrainian fascist diaspora of the various OUN-related organizations, the UCCA and others, the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America. In For the Record, Program 824, we took a look at a very important article by George Eliason, and he discusses the history of Ukrainian ultranationalism and fascism and traced the various anti-Russian and anti-Soviet networks that ultimately came to be dominated by the OUND and the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, which the OUND dominated. That evolution was traced back to the Spring of Nations that was implemented by the Austro-Hungarian Empire in the mid-19th century. To make a very long story very short, what that entailed was encouraging a virulent, aggressive, and often violent nationalism in the various states that made up the Austro-Hungarian Empire. These various nationalities were encouraged to be very overtly exceptionalist and aggressive. That, however, as part of an enthusiastic participation in a somewhat federalized Austro-Hungarian Empire. Ultimately, the Spring of Nations led to the Promethean networks that we talked about in AFA 14 and came back to again in, For the Record, 782. And those anti-Russian and anti-Soviet networks, again, coalesced under the OUND and the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations. We have looked at the irredentist inclinations of the Habsburg dynasty. Karl von Habsburg heads up the UNPO that has been encouraging various ethnic nationalities. The UNPO, by the way, stands for Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization. It holds as its first success the secession of Kosovo under the Kosovo Liberation Army, itself directly evolved from fascist fighting forces from World War II, including the 21st Waffen-SS Division, or Skanderbeg Division. The division of Yugoslavia was enthusiastically supported and lobbied for by Otto von Habsburg, the heir to the House of Habsburg. His son, Karl, has again founded the UNPO, which, by the way, looks basically to support the quasi-secession of the Lakota, the badly abused Lakota Nation in the U.S. That would not coincidentally involve the elimination of the Bakken oil formation or shale oil formation in the U.S. as well. If one looks at the geopolitics of the UNPO, you will find that the unrepresented nations and peoples that they advocate very often, more often than not, involve areas that are very rich in mineral resources, petroleum in particular, fossil fuels in particular. The Habsburgs have been very active politically in Europe, and we are going to be taking a look at their activism on behalf of, or in and on behalf of Hungary, their activism in and on behalf of Georgia, one of the Promethean nations discussed at some length in For the Record 824 in the aforementioned George Eliasson essay. And in particular, we're going to be taking a look at the long history of Habsburg influence in Ukraine, the Western Ukraine or Galicia in particular. And we are going to take a look at present Habsburg activism in Ukraine. Again, a long-standing part of their empire. I would note before we get into this that the perspectives of the European elites, the royal houses of Europe and their associated aristocracies, is very different than here in the U.S. In the U.S., it's the who has their 15 minutes of fame, who's hot and who's not. If the latest Disney Corp-generated post-teen bimbo du jour shows up at an awards ceremony with a see-through dress and no underwear, that's going to dominate the news cycle for the better part of a month. On the other hand, the Habsburgs, the Hohenzollerns, the European ruling houses and their associated aristocracies look at things in terms of hundreds of years. They take a look and say, well, during the Crusades, we did this right and we did this right, but we did this wrong, and this wrong, so let's not make that mistake again. Then, during the Reformation, we did this right and this right, but we did this wrong, so we'll correct that. During the 30 Years' War, we did this right and this right and this right, but we did this wrong and this wrong and this wrong, so let's make appropriate adjustments in terms of policy. And during the Napoleonic Wars, etc. And meantime, in the U.S., it's just the latest gyrations of the Kardashian family and other appropriate nonsense. It reminds me of author Edith Wharton's very profound statement that, quote, a frivolous society can only achieve dramatic significance through what its frivolity destroys, indeed. Well, the Europeans and the European royal houses have a very different perspective. Witness the following from the London Independent of December 23rd of 1996. This is an article by Adrian Bridge, B-R-I-D-G-E. Descendants of last Habsburg emperor climb ladder to power. Hungary looks to its empire of the past for a new beginning. And this reads in part, in what must rank as one of the most unlikely political comebacks of the century, the descendants of the last Habsburg emperor are once again making their mark in the central European territories that their family ruled for hundreds of years. Not surprisingly, the comeback revolves around the cities of Vienna and Budapest, the twin centers of power in the latter years of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which at its peak stretched from the Adriatic to what is now Ukraine. The most striking example of the trend is the appointment this week of Georg, G-E-O-R-G, von Habsburg, the 30-year-old grandson of Emperor Karl I, to the position of Hungary's ambassador for European integration. In neighboring Austria, the traditional heart of Habsburg power, Georg's brother Karl, 35, was recently elected to represent the country in the European Parliament. In addition to this, he serves as the president of the Austrian branch of the Pan-European Movement. Skipping down. And they're talking about the possibility that they might once again want to establish a monarchy and being poo-pooed by some members of the family. But the same is not true of all the members of the family. Before his election to the European Parliament in October, George von Habsburg's older brother Karl refused to be drawn when he was quizzed on the issue. When he was asked if he believed the Habsburg monarchy could return, his circumspect reply was, never say never again, unquote. And the Habsburg princess has now been is now the Georgian ambassador to Germany as Georgia attempts to implement the Promethean League / ABN boxing in and ultimately partition. Russia, Georgia has been very supportive of some of the Islamist jihadis of the Muslim Brotherhood who have been backed by elements of Saudi and Western intelligence. An article from The Economist magazine of February 18th of 2010, The Princess and the Bear, reads in part as follows. Georgia struggles to make its case in Germany, which sees trade ties with Russia as vital, and the ex-Soviet, this by the way in 2010, the ex-Soviet Caucasian Republic as troublesome. So who better to burnish Georgia's image there than a German-educated Habsburg? Georgia's new ambassador to Berlin, once she presents her credentials to the president next month, will be Gabriella Maria Charlotte Felicitas Elizabeth Antonia von Habsburg-Lothringen, Princess Imperial and Archduchess of Austria, Princess Royal of Hungary and Bohemia. A name like that, says Georgia's President Mikhail Saakashvili, should open doors. Well, it just may open the door to nuclear war, among other things, continuing. Speaking, I've been skipping down and speaking of the influence of the Russian ambassador in Berlin. But she may still help Germans think again about Georgia's European roots and future, translation, with the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Born in Luxembourg, brought up in Germany and Austria, the polyglot Ms. von Habsburg is an avant-garde sculptor specializing in large steel outdoor works. She has lived in Georgia since 2001, has become a Georgian citizen, and gained the command of the language, skipping down. By the standards of her family, a spot of diplomacy in Berlin is not particularly exotic. The heirs to the Habsburg emperors helped speed the downfall of the Soviet Empire, particularly by arranging the cross-border exodus from Hungary to Austria in the summer of 1989 that punched the first big hole in the Iron Curtain. Note their role in the Cold War and the final stages of the destabilization of the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe that I discussed in AFA Program 36. Continuing, among Ms. von Habsburg's six siblings, her younger sister, Walburga, is a leading conservative politician in Sweden. Her brother, Georg, is an ambassador-at-large for Hungary. Another used to be in the European Parliament. That is Karl of the UNPO. And speaking of Karl, he is very active in the city and district of Lviv, where a street was named in honor of the Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall or Nachtigall Battalion, commanded by Roman Shukevich, that was the formation that liquidated the Jewish and Polish population of the city of Lviv. The following is from the Kiev Post of April 20th of 2010. Karl von Habsburg keeps ancestors' profile alive in Lviv. This is by Natalia A. Fedushak, F-E-D-U-S-C-H-A-K. It reads in part. Karl von Habsburg laughed heartily when asked what it feels like to walk the streets of Lviv, a city that was once ruled by his ancestors. I look at it from an academic point of view, he said with a smile. It had nothing to do with me, unquote. Despite his easy manner, however, von Habsburg evidently has no intention of letting the past, particularly his ancestors, role remain lifeless in history books. Nearly a century after the Habsburg monarchy's rule ended in Europe, he is dedicating himself to ensure that its legacy lives on in Western Ukraine. And skipping down. At the turn of the 20th century, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which gave Central and Eastern Europe much of its art, culture, and architecture, spanned from Ukraine's Carpathian Mountains down to the Adriatic Sea in the south. It encompassed more than 12 European peoples, and its monarchy, the Habsburgs, had enjoyed over 600 years of uninterrupted power. A recent book by renowned historian Timothy Snyder chronicles the life of Wilhelm von Habsburg, the member of the Habsburg family who was most closely aligned with Ukrainians. Titled The Red Prince, it brought renewed attention to the family's connections with the region. Better known as Vasil Vashani, that's V-A-S-H-Y-V-A-N-I-Y, Wilhelm was the youngest son of Archduke Karl Stefan, who was in line to eventually become King of Poland. In a bid to save his crumbling world in 1916, Emperor Franz Joseph I, along with his German counterpart, had created a Polish kingdom as an independent state with a hereditary monarchy. Wilhelm, however, had his own goal. He wanted to establish a monarchy on the territory of what is today's Western Ukraine. Snyder writes that the idea was well received, particularly among some Ukrainian military leaders and the church. A military officer by training, Wilhelm supported Ukraine's independent struggle during World War I. He fought with Ukrainian troops against the Russians and had schemed and cajoled a myriad of politicians to support his monarchical aspirations. Almost until his death at the hands of the Soviets in 1948, he was snatched off the streets of Vienna and transported to a prison in Kiev for working as an agent against the Soviet Union. Wilhelm believed this slice of the family's empire could be his. And again, Karl von Habsburg appears intent on bringing that back to fruition, or basically re-implementing that. Remember that Karl von Habsburg, in addition to heading up UNPO, which among other things looks to apparently break up parts of the U.S., that's the United States. Again, I warned that the Spring of Nations sword we are wielding against Russia and China will be used against us. Karl von Habsburg also married Francesca Thyssen-Bornemisza in the Zagreb Cathedral in Croatia, and some of the executives of the private satellite reconnaissance company providing us with photographs about Ukraine have backgrounds with IHS, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of Thyssen-Bornemisza Industries. Continuing with this article, the Habsburg era has undergone somewhat of a renaissance lately in Western Ukraine, the new foundation of which is just the latest in that trend. A conference held late last year brought scholars from around the country to Chernivtsi, which along with Lvov is considered an important city in the region. And skipping down. Still, von Habsburg, that's Karl, and his relatives remain politically active. And again, that is about the Habsburg family. And Karl said quizzically, it's a family that hasn't focused on just one part of the world, you bet. And another article here, Karl von Habsburg is now supporting a radio station in Ukraine. From the Euractiv blog, E-U-R-A-C-T-I-V, of January 22nd of 2014, by Georgi Gotev, G-O-T-E-V, Karl Habsburg Lothringen, that's how he's called in Austria, that's what he's called in Austria, Lothringen, L-O-T-H-R-I-N-G-E-N. We now have a truly European radio station in Ukraine. It reads in part, since January 20th, a truly European radio station is broadcasting in Ukraine. Its main sponsor, Karl Habsburg Lothringen, told Euractiv in an exclusive interview. Karl Habsburg Lothringen is an Austrian politician and head of the House of Habsburg. Since 1986, he has served as president of the Austrian branch of the Pan-European Union. Habsburg Lothringen was an MEP between 1996 and 1999. He is chairman of Blue Shield, the Organization for Protection of Cultural Heritage in Armed Conflicts. And skipping down again, speaking of his radio station. And, of course, what it really has as a goal is to create a bit of the European spirit in Ukraine, which I think is quite important because in communications with Ukraine, a lot of things have gone badly or wrongly lately, so I think it would be very good to have an outlet there that carries a strong European message. And skipping down. There will definitely be both the Russian and Ukrainian languages, and we have the possibility to weigh it according to where we are broadcasting. Are you getting some support from the EU or elsewhere? You should be transparent or you will end up being branded an American outlet. And he says, currently, that's called an Habsburg. The project is funded entirely by individuals. There is no state involved. It would be interesting to know who those individuals are. And something about the family history of the Habsburgs. This very quickly from the book, The New Reich, Violent Extremism in Unified Germany and Beyond by Michael Schmidt. Of Otto von Habsburg, the father of Karl von Habsburg, the final, who, by the way, was networking with Jaroslav Stetsko, the World War II head of state of the puppet regime in Ukraine, who presided over the slaughter of hundreds of thousands in the Nazi ethnic cleansing of Ukraine. Again, Otto von Habsburg was networking with Jaroslav Stetsko, as we looked at in For the Record 824. That's not the only group with which he has been networking. Again, from The New Reich by Michael Schmidt. The final escalation was reserved for Otto von Habsburg, a CSU delegate to the European Parliament and the son of the last Austrian emperor. Since 1973, he has also been president of the ultra-right Pan-Europa Union and a member of the Freedom for Rudolf Hess Committee. By the way, that Rudolf Hess was one of Hitler's top deputies. And concluding from the book American Dynasty, Aristocracy, Fortune, and the Politics of Deceit in the House of Bush by Kevin Phillips, copyright 2004, it is more than eerie. A disturbing sidebar to the political culture of these restorations was how many of the would-be monarchs, royal houses, and supporting factions had been on the fascist side in World War II. Italy's House of Savoy was banished in part for backing Mussolini and supporting his 1938 race laws targeting Jews. In Bulgaria, Simeon's House of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha fought through much of the war as an ally of Nazi Germany. The Serbian factions backing the potential Alexander II evoked memories of World War II massacres and ethnic battles still commemorated after 600 years. The Romanian House of Hohenzollern-Sigmaringen, supported by the Iron Guard movement that blended rural Eastern Orthodox religion with folkish nationalism, fought most of World War II on Hitler's side. And, of course, the Habsburgs, about whom we have been speaking. Again, the SpitfireList.com website will have a long article-length written description with all of the relevant text excerpts in it, plus material I did not have time to read. Please do use that and the other materials available for free at SpitfireList.com. This concludes For the Record program number 833, Shooting Ourselves in the Foot in Ukraine, subtitled Habsburg Redux. This is being recorded on January 30th of the year 2015.